How's everyone tonight? Well, we've arrived at the shores of understanding death in the hereafter, as assisted, like blind people, with the vision of the central figures of the faith. The first section, we touched a little on this last week, the difference of degrees in creation is a barrier to understanding. We should have a few texts to support the thoughts that we were expressing. This is an extract from a tablet of Abdu'l-Bahá. He says, "Thou hast written, how is it possible to imagine a life after death? Verily, verily, life after death is not imaginable. But do thou observe that as that it is evident man has evolved from the mineral world, as long as he was in the mineral kingdom, he could not imagine the vegetable kingdom. He was transferred to the vegetable kingdom. In the vegetable kingdom, he could not imagine the animal kingdom. Before he emerged from the animal kingdom, he could not imagine the stage of human reason and intelligence. That is, it was impossible for him. He did not have any knowledge thereof. Now this earth and these trees have by no means any knowledge of the animal and human worlds. They cannot imagine them. They deny existence absolutely. While the human world is helping the animal and assisting the vegetable kingdoms, the vegetable is ignorant of it. Similarly, the human world cannot comprehend the world of the kingdom, which is absolutely ignorant of it, while the heavenly souls have influence in the human world. Do thou observe how clear this point is, and yet the professors and philosophers of the world are ignorant of this reality." Then he adds on, he says, "The mediums, however, are speaking of the world of thought and not of reality." Mediums, you all understand the term mediums means, those that claim to mediate between the spiritual realm, or the realm of those souls who have passed over to the other side, and the ones that are here, like in the form of seance or table rapping or those various things. Now Abdu'l-Bahá says this is not reality. It proceeds from their own thoughts, these things. He describes this in other places. We'll have some further readings on that. But he does go on to say, "But a heavenly soul who is conscious of the divine world and that of the spirits," this is a corrected at 3:7, this has got misprint, sorry. We're going to come to that. I think we're going to come back to this. I'll read that later on. It has to do with heavenly souls being able to perceive to some degree the other world. He talks about reality being pure spirit and not physical. That is to say, it does not occupy space. That's another subject still, isn't it? And then again in a tablet of the Master, the answer to the first question, "The souls of the children of the kingdom after their separation from the body ascend under the realm of everlasting life. But if ye ask as to the place, know ye that the world of existence is a single world, although its stations are various and distinct. For example, the mineral life occupieth its own plane, but a mineral entity is without any awareness at all of the vegetable kingdom, and indeed with its inner tongue denieth that there is any such kingdom. In the same way, a vegetable entity knoweth nothing of the animal world, remaining completely heedless and ignorant thereof, for the stage of the animal is higher than that of the vegetable, and the vegetable is veiled from the animal world and inwardly denieth the existence of that world. All this while animal, vegetable, and mineral dwell together in the one world. In the same way, the animal remaineth totally unaware of that power of the human mind which graspeth universal ideas and layeth bare the secrets of creation, so that a man who liveth in the East can make plans and arrangements for the West, can unravel mysteries, and although located on the continent of America, of Europe, can discover America, although sighted on the earth, can lay hold of the inner realities of the stars of heaven. Of this power of discovery, which belongeth to the human mind, this power which can grasp abstract and universal ideas, the animal remaineth totally ignorant, and indeed denieth its existence. In the same way, the denizens of this earth are completely unaware of the world of the kingdom, and deny the existence thereof. They ask, for example, where is the kingdom? Where is the Lord of the kingdom? These people are even as the mineral and the vegetable, who know nothing whatever of the animal and the human realm. They see it not, they find it not. Yet the mineral and vegetable, the animal and man, are all living here together in this world of existence. Baha'u'llah in a tablet says, the world beyond is as different from this world as this world is different from that of the child while still in the womb of its mother. Think of that difference between that world that you were once in, that stage, that first stage of your existence, in the womb of your mother. And what a different world this is. And how if when we were in that stage, someone spoke to us that you're going to be born, you're going to leave this dark world, and you're going to be born into a world of endless light and vast expanses of space to which no one can find the end, studded with luminous stars and a sun and a moon, and you'll see the face of an earth covered with rivers and streams and flowers and trees and fruits on the trees that if you taste them, you don't even know what taste is yet, but you'll find out what taste is in that world. And you'll drink beverages, and you'll have beautiful times there. You'll see how this is. And the child is listening to all this and thinking, yeah, sure. Like we say here, yeah. Paradise, oh, okay, it's great. Now we have something from the Bab. He says, this is another vantage on this whole thing of life after death. He says, it is better for a man to guide a soul than to possess all that lies between East and West. Likewise, better is guidance for him who is guided than all the things that exist on earth. For by reason of this guidance, he will, after his death, gain admittance into paradise, whereas by reason of the things of the world below, he will, after his death, receive his deserts. And again from the Bab. And the answer to the fourth question. No, I'm sorry, this is from Abdu'l-Bahá. The answer to the fourth question. The center of the Sun of Truth is in the supernal world, the kingdom of God. Those souls who are pure and unsullied, upon the dissolution of their elemental forms, hasten away to the world of God. And that world is within this world. The people of this world, however, are unaware of that world, and are even as the mineral and the vegetable that know nothing of the world of the animal and the world of man. So now he's been telling us all these realms of existence are here in one world. He's telling us that that world is also in this world. It's no division. It's here present. But it's a certain capacity is needed in order to become aware of its reality and its benefits. There's another tablet. 19:7. You had asked concerning the disclosure of spirits after the dissolution of bodies. Undoubtedly, the other world is a world of disclosure and vision. For there the veil will be removed, and the human spirit will witness the souls above it, beneath it, or of an equal rank with it. As an example of this, when man was in the fetal world, he had a veil before the eyes, and all things were therefore covered from him. When he was born out of the matrix into this world, because this world in comparison to the fetal world is a world of disclosure and vision, he can witness all things here with his outward eye. Likewise, when he departs from this world into the other world, whatever was veiled from him in this world will become disclosed to him in the other. And in that world he will comprehend and perceive all things with the eye of insight, and will witness those like him, equal to him, above him, or outside of him. As to the equality of spirits in the supreme world, by this is meant that the spirits of the believers at the time of their appearance in the world of bodies are equal and are all pure and unsullied. But in this world they will find distinction. Some attain to a lofty station. Some seek an intermediate grade or stagnate in the early stages. This equality of the spirits is in the original state of their beings, and this distinction is after their ascension or departure from this earthly life. Any questions? My goodness. So we hear about grades in the kingdom, and it depends on the distinction gained in this life. We hear about the opening of the eye of insight, and through it witnessing the realities of the other realm. Now, in the first part of the course, there was also references to opening the eye, the true eye, the eye of insight, to become aware of spiritual realities and so on. The same thing can happen in this life. That is, to some degree, the eye of insight will perceive divine truths while we're living here. And the whole point of that is, of course, if we have our eye of insight open here, when we go there, then we'll really see clearly. Now, Abdu'l-Bahá gives various proofs in different places about the immortality of the spirit, which in different ways give us other means of approach to the subject. He talks about the logical proof of the immortality of the spirit, which he says is this: that no sign can come from a non-existing thing. That is to say, it is impossible that from absolute non-existence signs should appear. For the signs are the consequence of an existence, and the consequence depends upon the existence of the principle. So from a non-existing sun, no light can radiate, and from a non-existing sea, no waves appear, and from a non-existing cloud, no rain falls. A non-existing tree yields no fruit. A non-existing man neither manifests nor produces anything. Therefore, as long as signs of existence appear, they are a proof that the possessor of the sign is existent. Consider that today the kingdom of Christ exists. From a non-existing king, how could such a great kingdom be manifested? How from a non-existing sea can the waves mount so high? From a non-existing garden, how can such fragrant breezes be wafted? Reflect that no effect, no trace, no influence remains of any being after its members are dispersed and its elements are decomposed, whether it be a mineral, a vegetable, or an animal. There is only the human reality and the spirit of man which, after the disintegration of the members, dispersing of the particles, and the destruction of the composition, persists and continues to act and to have power. This question is extremely subtle. Consider it attentively. This is a rational proof which we are giving, so that the wise may weigh it in the balance of reason and justice. But if the human spirit will rejoice and be attracted to the kingdom of God, if the inner sight becomes opened and the spiritual hearing strengthened and the spiritual feelings predominant, he will see the immortality of the spirit as clearly as he sees the sun and the glad tidings and signs of God will encompass him. That's from some answered questions. The last line says, tomorrow we will give other proofs. You can look up in some answered questions. This is page 210 of the British edition to see what the proofs were of the next day as well. They're in another part of this course, as I recall. While in Paris, Abdu'l-Bahá said, the very existence of man's intelligence proves his immortality. Moreover, darkness proves the presence of light. For without light there would be no shadow. Poverty proves the existence of riches, for without riches how could we measure poverty? Ignorance proves that knowledge exists, for without knowledge how could there be ignorance? Therefore the idea of mortality presupposes the existence of immortality, for if there were no life eternal, there would be no way of measuring the life of this world. Abdu'l-Bahá, you know, was invited to travel across the Atlantic on the Titanic, which had a tragic end, and he said that he preferred another ship, and arranged his affairs, and you know, as he went on another ship. Well, when he got to New York, of course, the Titanic disaster was there. And he says, I am consoled. This is in relation to those that died in that tragedy. I'm consoled by the realization that the worlds of God are infinite. That though they were deprived of this existence, they have other opportunities in the life beyond. Even as His Holiness Christ has said, in my Father's house are many mansions. They were called away from the temporary and transferred to the eternal. They abandoned this material existence and entered the portals of the spiritual world, foregoing the pleasures and comforts of the earthly. They now partake of a joy and happiness far more abiding and real. For they have hastened to the kingdom of God. The mercy of God is infinite, and it is our duty to remember these departed souls in our prayers and supplications, that they may draw nearer and nearer to the source itself. I think we're all familiar with it. Prayers reassured for those that have passed into the next world are effective. And particularly we have here the special grace of being able to pray for the departed in the shrines and ask the blessings of the shrines, independent of anything else, to be showered upon our loved ones and friends and those that have passed on. And we're told, we'll see when we discuss the activities of the souls in the other world, that they are also commanded to pray for the souls here. And Abdu'l-Bahá says the prayers that we have for our loved ones are more effective in that world than they are in this world. You know, you think, well, they're departed. Here we pray and pray, and sometimes we don't see the things we want to have happen. But there they have greater effect. Do you want to make any comments or ask anything? Please. Yes, Abdu'l-Bahá says very clearly that animals don't subsist after death. But there seems to be some kind of collective reality, species reality, which appears, it keeps appearing. It's one reality in all the animals. You know, there's a closeness that, for instance, when you see, if you're diving and you see fish, small fish together, they all turn at the same time. You'll have a school of them, and they're as if they were one creature, you know. And there's this there's this natural connection in the species and so on. So there is similarity. So the species, the animal, persists by its offspring, and those qualities continue to show themselves in a different way, demonstrating the oneness of the species, but also demonstrating the multiplicity of its effects in the world of creation. That is, the variety of differences that can appear within a single species, which again is proof of the creative power of God, God the Fashioner. Now that on Abdu'l-Bahá's trip, sometimes he was asked about that, or somebody had heard about it and would come and say to him, "One, I think there's a story about a lady that said about Abdu'l-Bahá, what about my dog? You know, what will happen to my dog? And I won't have my dog, and I don't should want to go to the other world without her dog." And the master said that if you need your dog in the other world, you shall have her. What a nice answer. So covers the case, you know. He knows what she would need, of course. But there may be dogs and cats in the other world, but they're not the ones that were here. There may be something there that you can accompany you and satisfy you, you know, but without being the ones, the Israeli variety here or something. That's a valid wonder, I should imagine. Now we know that, we read earlier, the tests of God are in this world and not in that world, and that's the source of light, and by comparison with this, we'll be overjoyed. But he also talks about the ones that haven't prepared themselves properly will quake on entering the next world, you know, they will suffer. They'll come to a realization of the lost opportunities they have. I was just reading yesterday about the opportunities that exist in the cause today to teach the cause, to spread the cause, are unique. And there's no way to atone for the loss of not seizing those opportunities for the soul. You can atone for other things, but lost opportunities as far as propagating the faith, you can't make up for them. It's an interesting concept. So we'll no doubt, all the opportunities that we've missed, we'll have some suffering over. In the sense of, you know, Baha'u'llah sent us some precious soul to teach the faith, and we went to the movie, or we did something else. You know, we just didn't notice, or we never thought they'd be interested in the faith. And in the other world, they tell us, "I came to you, and you didn't tell me." You know, sometimes that happens in this life too. People telling you, "Why did you take so long to get here?" Well, you see, it wasn't me, it was my grandfather who should have come, but he didn't come, so generation after generation. But we really can't say, but I have the impression from everything we read that for the most part, entry into the next world will be pleasant, very uplifting. Messenger of joy, as Paul said. Any other point?
Most of our experiences with how birth is a painful experience are second hand. I don't think very many people remember being smacked in the rump in the operating room.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if it's not in the same way there. Somewhat of a painful entry, but perhaps what would be the equivalent of 1,000 years later when we remember it.
Maybe it's the painful exit rather than the painful entry, I don't know. And then we have the assurance of Abdu'l-Bahá that we remember this life when we pass, whereas it's different with the fetal stage. We don't remember things from that. It's another degree of consciousness, of awareness.
I vaguely remember reading a passage that
seems that it inferred that the first few days or the initial period after a soul departs from this world or is attached to this physical form is somewhat special in regards to I almost got the impression that it was almost like a transitional phase. Have you ever read anything that refers to that?
It doesn't sound comical, but I can't remember hearing anything really from the tablets. But the moment of death, there are some quotes that will come here, perhaps something that will fill it.
Perhaps it was in reference to how we should pray and when praying for the departed.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's speaking of additional attention being paid to the initially following the death. I'm sorry that.
Well, there's a lot of this kind of idea in public consciousness because of the books on near-death experiences of being so similar all over when they were collected, of people who departed their bodies and then came back for one reason or another, or sent back, or told to go back, or found themselves suddenly awake again because somebody had properly juiced up their heart or something had happened there. They found themselves back again, and most of them with a much better attitude towards life because of that experience, and feeling secure that when they go there's light on the other side, and it's a wonderful and soothing light, and it speaks to you and reveals to you your everything about you and various things. And there they talk about this transition period, a tunneling and a recapitulation of all of the events of one's life, and even little things that, like the saving of a bee out of water on a stream or something that God would remember, in a sense that we wouldn't perhaps remember, and that was on the right side of the scale for us for the balance of good and evil deeds and so on. We'll have to wait to see some more of that. Please. What they think is the other world is really a product of their own thoughts, or the thoughts of each other, and not something that's really based in the other world. Not that we would consider valid for this life, to use in this life. More than a gift, it would be a curse, and I would try to free themselves of such influences if they had them. Knowing that they, as the Master said, they would lead to the damage of those faculties that the soul needs in the next world, where they properly operate. It isn't that we deny psychic powers, but we say they are something reserved. It's like if you wanted to, open your eyes while they were developing in the womb and use them to look around. I mean, you didn't need them there, really, and that you got all carried away with using them, and then there were liquids in the womb that weren't supposed to get in the eyes, and it's just not the proper place for them to operate. I don't know what examples we can use, but along that line, And the Master says, don't seek to do these things or try to practice them. Now, sometimes supernatural things come to the believers; they come spontaneously. One remains passive to them, praise God, and mention the greatest name. And if He wants you to have an experience, you'll have an experience. But not to go out seeking it, so to speak, simply trying to force a loved one to come to you or something like that. But if you, at the other hand, you spontaneously reach out in prayer to someone that you're close to, that's already passed on the other side, oftentimes it will create a harmonic feeling, a close feeling that whether this is the reality of the other soul or it's your own soul rejoicing and thinking about the other world or what it is, but it's different from the normal experience. And yet it's not psychic in the sense of receiving discursive speech or hearing voices or trumpets or table tapping or things like that. Again, there's been research into all these various psychic phenomena, and it isn't that it's not real, it's just there seems to be some cases that imply the reality of these forces, but that's not a surprise for us as Baha'is because we have the information of Abdu'l-Bahá that they do exist. It's just the question of the proper use of them not being here.
Remember, talked about other worlds and worlds to come, and I was wondering whether this could imply that the process of leaving one world and being born into the next is a process that doesn't stop in the next world. That is, it would continue on and on, like being born into the next world, and then that person would leave the next world and be born into another world, and so forth. Does one believe this?
I think it's a question of degrees of the world of the kingdom, you know. As he says again, he says existence is all one. But there's each of the degrees, when you reach that degree and you're elevated by God to another degree, then you have a new life. You take on, it's like spiritual rebirth. Here we are. We're born again into the world of the kingdom. We've taken on the spirit of faith, and through it we're able to actually affirm realities and things that we couldn't before that. And we live as a different person from what we were when we weren't Baha'is. Maybe it's something like that. There, Abdu'l-Bahá describes the degrees of the soul. First he describes the degrees of spirit in this life, of mineral and vegetable and animal and the rational soul. Then he describes the soul confirmed by faith. And he describes a whole series of other... He continues the series. And those other degrees of the development of the soul that are characterized like the seven valleys as different stages are as if they were new worlds, new stages of existence, new stages of being. And Baha'u'llah talks about these infinite worlds of God, and you will attain to each and every one of them. Abdu'l-Bahá in a tablet says these worlds are not the other physical planets. You know, somebody said, well, does it mean we go to the appear in other worlds? And no, we know we're not born here again, but are we born again in Pluto or something like that? You know? But no, once you leave this physical realm, this mortal realm, then you're in a spiritual kingdom. But that has infinite worlds and degrees and so on. Someone else has something.
I was just wondering, in this world you have a dual spiritual, you're in the process of compassion, right? And I think it's kind of passing away little by little. As you get attached to this world, you get closer to the other world. So when you pass away, you pass away not because of your will, but because of the will of God. I was just wondering if you, in the process that you get detached, if you can ask for inspiration, like for art, and like more specific, like art, and you ask for the other, like souls, and for inspiration, for to increase your communication with the other world so you can manifest.
There exists an interesting exchange of letters. And Shoghi Effendi and one of the earlier believers, a woman who had invested a lot of time in automatic handwriting and painting, believing that if she could become spiritually attracted to that stage, she would be able to produce great works of art. And she written to the Guardian say she was rather disappointed. Sometimes they'd be all right, but oftentimes they were kind of confused, and the results were irregular, so to speak. And he wrote back and mentions to her that that what she was doing sounded a bit as if she were engaging in psychic practices, and that she should know that the great arts and sciences flow to man. The inspiration that flows to man flows in a normal way to them, in thought, and through the development of one's talents. And this was the natural way in which these gifts of the kingdom came to us. That we didn't need to get ourselves into some kind of a psychic state in order to get the inspiration. You know? And he said there are passages in the writings that seem to imply that, but that's not what's meant by them. That we purify our hearts, and then our normal thinking is elevated and is another state, and we conceive of truths. But we need to develop art both from the side of craft and the side of inspiration. Both. So though we're told that the detached souls are the leaven of the arts and sciences in this life, it isn't as if, you know, we have a few of them assigned to us and we know their get to know their names and they tell us what to do. It's just the normal way of study and making efforts and struggling with to produce as writers do, as poets do. Of course, oftentimes the creative aspect, they feel they've been inspired at one moment. They'll conceive of a whole thing. You know, but it works through mind, it's spirit, but it acts mainly through the faculty of mind, and it's expressed. It can be with deep feeling, but it needs the mind to figure out how to put that feeling into a work of art that can then express the intention to another soul, to another viewer. Again, in a talk in America, he says, let's see, we've covered this subject. Here Abdu'l-Bahá approaches this, what we're talking about, the difference between the world of the matrix and this world, and gives it another focus. He says, these human conditions may be likened to the matrix of the mother from which a child is to be born into the spacious outer world. At first, the infant finds it very difficult to reconcile itself to its new existence. It cries as if not wishing to be separated from its narrow abode and imagining that life is restricted to that limited space. It is reluctant to leave its home, but nature forces it into this world. Having come into its new conditions, it finds that it has passed from darkness into a sphere of radiance. From gloomy and restricted surroundings, it has been transferred to an environment spacious and delightful. Its nourishment was the blood of the mother. Now it finds delicious food to enjoy. Its new life is filled with brightness and beauty. It looks with wonder and delight upon the mountains, meadows, and fields of green, the rivers and fountains, the wonderful stars. It breathes the life-giving atmosphere, and then it praises God for its release from the confinement of its former condition, an attainment to the freedom of a new realm. This analogy expresses the relation of the temporal world to the life hereafter. The transition of the soul of man from darkness and uncertainty to the light and reality of the eternal kingdom. At first it is very difficult to welcome death, but after attaining its new condition, the soul is grateful for it has been released from the bondage of the limited to enjoy the liberties of the unlimited. It has been freed from a world of sorrow, grief, and trials to live in a world of unending bliss and joy. The phenomenal and physical have been abandoned in order that it may attain the opportunities of the ideal and the spiritual. In Notes from London, when Abdu'l-Bahá was in London, says that Mrs. S., whoever that was, asked some questions with reference to the conditions of existence in the next world and the life after death. She said that having recently lost a very near relative, she had given much thought to this subject. Many thought that reunion with those we had loved, who had passed on to the future life, would only take place after a long period of time had elapsed. She wished to know whether one would be reunited with those who had gone before, immediately after death. Abdu'l-Bahá answered this, saying that this would depend upon the respective stations of the two. If both had the same degree of development, they would be reunited immediately after death. The questioner then said, how could this state of development be acquired? Abdu'l-Bahá replied, by unceasing effort, striving to do right, and to attain to spiritual qualities. The questioner remarked that many different opinions were held as to the conditions of the future life. Some thought that all would have exactly the same perfections and virtues, that all would be equal and alike. Abdu'l-Bahá said, there would be variety and differing degrees of attainment, as in this world. The question was then asked as how it would be possible with no material bodies or environment to recognize different entities and characters when all would be in the same conditions and on the same plane of existence. Abdu'l-Bahá said, if several people look into a mirror at the same moment, they behold all the different personalities, their characteristics and movements. Yet the glass of the mirror into which they look is one. In your mind you have a variety of thoughts, but all these thoughts are separate and distinct. Also, you may perhaps have hundreds of friends, but when you call them before your memory, you do not confuse them one with another. Each one is separate and distinct, having their own individualities and characteristics. Very interesting analogy he's drawn there. When the master was on the steamship, the SS Celtic, a woman came to him with her problem. She was afraid of death. He said to her, then do something that will keep you from dying. That will instead, day by day, make you more alive and bring you everlasting life. According to the words of His Holiness Christ, those who enter the kingdom of God will never die. Then enter the kingdom, the divine kingdom, and fear death no more. They spoke of the Atlantic Ocean. It was temporarily quiet. He advised, one must ride in the ship of God, for this life is a stormy sea, and all the people on earth, that is over 2 billion souls that time, will drown in it before 100 years have passed. All except those who ride in the ship of God, those will be saved. Is cited in volume 13 of the Baha'i World on page 1187. It's from Mahmud's diary. This is now... I put together everything here. There's some pilgrim notes, too. Now, these are pilgrim notes from the Master Steins. One of the early American pilgrims has noted this down. So you should bear this in mind with respect to the other tablets that we've heard and the other things that we'll study and see what you can make and what may be interesting from it. It's worth reading just for the things it suggests. It would be difficult, the Master said, to speak of the spiritual kingdom in any way to make our finite minds understand, or even grasp a faint conception of its mysteries and its glories. When we speak of love, a thing we all know well, we are obliged to make comparisons and say it is like fire in order to convey an idea to the intellectual mind. So in order to give a shadow of meaning, we compare the infinite everlasting kingdom to this world as it would seem to a baby still in the mother's womb. This much is true, and we can grasp it, that the spiritual is the real life. And when we reach there, this earthly existence will be to us a dream. And best of all the ties and relationships of true love and affection, that is, the relationship of the soul, not of the flesh, will be intensified 1,000 times. Just as much as we are capable of loving here, that much more we can love there. For this is the sleeping time, the time of preparation. We are only dreaming, and the real things can only be dimly realized. But these loves are the things which shall shine brightly when we enter the kingdom. The rest will all fade away. We will retain our individuality and will not be swallowed in one vast spirit. Love intensified 1,000 times. How would you like that? I say, be a true spiritual partner, you know. Dr. Bahas talks about the importance of being united. For if they're not united spiritually, then the relationship wouldn't endure.
So it would be, there wouldn't be a separation.
Sounds like there would be a separation, yes. If,
if
your spouse is a tremendous spiritual being and you're not doing anything to follow along... We can say the other way. If you're a tremendous spiritual being and your spouse is doing nothing to follow along, then you may not find yourselves compatible in the next world to the degree that the physical circumstances and companionship of this life would indicate. So he says, you know, make yourselves as one spiritually. No. There are a lot of people that are married that ask that question, I think, too. In all the worlds of God, my goodness. There's this story about Zeno Mukarrabin. You know, Zeno Mukarrabin is pictured in the first volume of the Revelation of Baha'u'llah. He was a scribe of Baha'u'llah, very holy man. In fact, Baha'u'llah said his sanctity was such that anything that he would intervene and ask Baha'u'llah or God for on the part of any soul would be granted, he said. He's written that in a tablet. Imagine the sanctity of this man. This man one day was in the presence of Baha'u'llah in a breakfast. They were eating and Zain was kind of looking down, and Baha'u'llah, perceiving what was his problem, started speaking to him about the importance of our wives and how we have to treat our wives well and how we have to be loving to our wives, and we should show them great kindness, and we should do this, and how we're dependent on them, and so on, all these things. Zain is listening without saying anything. Finally, Baha'u'llah caps the whole argument. He says, you know, that when you go to the spiritual world, you will be together in heaven. Zain says, could you arrange to send me to hell? There are those that say there are no saints without proper spouses.
Question of being united with another soul doesn't only apply to somebody you married. There's a letter from the guardian.
Oh yes, that's important. About
the fourth letter.
Soulmates, is that there?
It said that you should strive and be for to develop friendship, which will be eternal.
Are you hearing this? Speaking of, you know, we should probably take it from the point of view of soulmates. There was asked, the guardian was asked, well, what about soulmates? There was something in volume 7 of the Baha'i World, which everyone thought that the guardian was reading every word of what went in the Baha'i World, so that must be all right and be authentic. It spoke about soulmates, that each of us were created in pairs, and we should, you know, search and try to find our soulmates. But that we shouldn't be disappointed if we didn't find our soulmate in this life, we'd find them in the next world. And even if we did find our soulmate, sometimes the conditions of this life would be such that we wouldn't be happy together anyway. And this was all kind of mysterious, you know. So they wrote, the guardian asked him about soulmates. He said, we have no teaching about soulmates. There's no such thing as the fact that creatures have been created in pairs. It means that the human reality has been created in this world as men and women. And he explains that the closeness of the next world, the relationships of the next world, we should strive to have close spiritual relationships with each other. And that we would be close to those, whether they were our spouses or our family or close friends. In the next world, that is, like seeks like in the company of its kind. This is not in that letter, but this is the principle, that draws us together. When we have common affinities and common love, then we will be together. Now, how much those that are their whole devotion, the principal love and moving power in their life is love for Baha'u'llah. See how we'll all circle around him and around each other. We'll be together. Calls it the companions of the Crimson Arc. It refers to the people of Baha and their state in the next world. In a letter, the same letter actually to this lady who's doing the paintings and wants to really do something important, he said, the greatest thing you have done in this life, that you will do in this life, is to have accepted the faith. You can do lots of things. That, single and alone, is already sufficient. Now you hear the Christian saying this, you know, well, all you do is name the name of Jesus. That's it. That's the first, this of course a very important step. And entrance into the cause, Abdu'l-Bahá has written to Leonora Armstrong. Remember I mentioned at the Latin American evening, if you were there, she had this tablet. And in this tablet also he mentions this question. He says that entrance into the cause of God is accompanied by let's see if I'm getting the two elements here. Everlasting honor and eternal sovereignty. Everlasting honor and eternal sovereignty. Now you want to remember that to be able to tell people when they come into the faith that the Master has said this about the time when one accepts the cause. Everlasting honor and eternal sovereignty. What's this sovereignty, my goodness? That thine may be a sovereignty ancient, imperishable, and everlasting. Same. See these elements here. Now, there's no giving and taking in marriage in the other world. It also states in the teachings. And Abdu'l-Bahá says in one tablet that the soul doesn't have sex. Sex has to do with this physical, mortal world. So the differentiation of men and women, he says, is an accident of the nature of whether you're Turkish or Chinese or South American or whatever you are, you know, that's, and the time you're born. There's certain things that when you're born, where you're born, and whether you're born as a man or a woman. Now, this is very interesting from the point of view of all of the concerns about this shows that Baha'is are not affirming the equality of the sexes because they don't allow women on the House of Justice. Now, if the Baha'i teachings say that the soul, in its essence, has no distinction at all, it's one soul. It may have feminine expression or masculine expression in this life. It shows there's no essential inferiority in the quality of the soul. So it must have to do something in relation to the functions and role of woman. In other words, it's more likely you'll find reasons in that direction than becoming too involved with the thought that women are inferior or are half the soul that men are, as some of the previous religions taught. So it's not going to make any difference when we go to the other world from that point of view. And another argument, just to mention this kind of in between everything else here, because this question arises so much, is that in the cause, the hierarchy of importance of the figures as understood by the House of Justice is that the guardian is the top and the hands of the cause, and then the House of Justice. Now, the House of Justice has become the head of the cause, so its importance becomes very great. And the membership on it is naturally a great honor and distinction. But the hands of the cause, the House of Justice defers to. And great hands of the cause were women. And the Master points out that the service of teaching the cause is very, very high. It has more distinction than administering the cause. Now, Shoghi Effendi in letters said that teaching has priority to administration. The administration of the cause is a wonderful service, but teaching is at the top. And then the Master says that women have excelled in this dispensation in the teaching and propagation of the cause. And they have been in the highest ranks of the servants of the faith and in response to Abdu'l-Bahá's divine call. And that in both the fields of teaching that we understand, pioneering on the one hand, and travel teaching, the exemplars, the archetypes for all the Baha'is of the world are women. Travel teaching is Martha Root. Shoghi Effendi says in her cable, in his cable, a memorial cable, at the end of her life, that she's the example to men and women, young and old, of the East and of the West, not just to the Westerners, but to all. She's the example of travel teaching. And then he chooses Marian Jack, who was pioneering and died in Bulgaria, as the exemplar for all pioneers, the model for pioneers, men and women, young and old, East and West. Again, there's this whole thing. Everybody should look to her qualities. So women have best exemplified this teaching spirit. And we extol that in the faith. And that position is higher than the members of the House of Justice. At least the House of Justice defers to all the hands of the cause. That should tell us something about the opportunities. You know, you say, well, how? It's not fair. You know, you want to really do something for the cause, but there's only 9 members of the House of Justice. There's only 9 members of the National Spiritual Assembly. There's only 10 board members in my country now. How am I ever going to have a chance to do anything for this faith? Teaching. Teaching is what you can do. No act greater, he says, than quickening one soul in the cause of God. That's a deed that lasts from here to the next world and has its effects. I never read that about going to a committee meeting. I have to do that too, but so we should never feel that someone else is filling our role. In fact, be grateful if all the administrative posts are filled up with capable people. That is just fine, just fine. It leaves you free to teach the cause of God, to breathe life into the souls of people. This really is the most important work. And he said, you can't use the fact that you're occupied with the administration as an excuse for not teaching. You know, it's not an acceptable substitute, with the single exception of the World Center, but you can teach each other in the World Center. And you do, I'm sure. We do, yeah. Okay. How did we get up on that subject? That was a good one. Please.
I have a friend who just had a stroke. And she said it's like he's a different person in the same body. And she said his personality has changed, his mental capacity has changed. What are we to do? This person who is 40 years old, and they live in 40 years like that.
So it's the same soul. Yes, the soul doesn't change. The soul is not affected by alterations in the body and the outward circumstances, physical outward circumstances. And it's as if living under a veil, like Alaska, where the sun doesn't come out, or something, you know. You have to adjust to a new condition. And there are physical limitations imposed by the body, which are a tremendous test. But I think that, you know, God knows all of these things and recompenses the individuals involved, and will also recompense fidelity in such cases. You know, faithfulness and caring for the sick is a great challenge. Gosh, why should I lose my whole life because he had a stroke, you know? I mean, found a home to put them in. Let somebody else feed him. I've got my life to live. Nice. All right. Maybe there's circumstances where that would be acceptable, but one has to weigh all these things. You know, how God views it all. What are we willing to give up to continue the expression of qualities which are essential to godly character and Baha'i life, so to speak? It's a challenge.
Writings support that in respect to children who are born sometimes with severe Down syndrome, the mental handicaps, if their souls are pristine and well preserved, and if they have physical
limitations. Yes, that the children who are ill or deformed or whatever, naturally there will be recompenses. And he says this life is like the blink of an eye, you know. It's just, when it's over, I mean, how long can this life be in comparison to eternity? It becomes flattened to nothing by comparison. It seems like a very full and important condition while we're here, but afterwards those things will be forgotten. I'm sure there are ways that the soul, if it's been kept back in its progress, will progress. And we don't know what the role of such souls is to those around them. We don't know what, you know, God has his mysteries. So a lot of people that have raised mongoloid children and so on have had tremendous experiences. Because, of course, their souls express themselves in different ways. Retarded children are oftentimes among the most loving of creatures, you know, if they're properly cared for. You see other qualities in them. Right here we've got some notes that I don't even know where they came from. So how would you like something like that? I know they're from the master. They're notes taken down by the master, but they're in old manuscripts, handwritten manuscripts in the States that I got a hold of. But let's see how it compares with everything else we know. It is a certain fact, absolutely established, that people, whether righteous or wicked, the people of light or of darkness, pious or mischievous, live on after the death of the body and physical dissolution. But the life of the wicked in comparison with the existence of the believers is as non-existence. This is why Christ speaks of this life of faith, as everlasting life. And he says, if you follow me, you will attain eternal life. And whosoever believes not on me is deprived of the life eternal. The meaning of Christ's saying was not that the unbelievers become absolutely annihilated. The meaning of Christ is that the life of those who reject him is as non-existent compared with the life of those who accepted. The mineral has existence, the vegetable has existence, but the existence of the inferior kingdom as compared with the existence of the human kingdom is as non-existence. Even the mineral is living in relation to its own kingdom. But the mineral kingdom in comparison with the vegetable is non-existent, and the vegetable compared with the animal is non-existent. The ignorant compared with the knower is dead. The rejected compared with the accepted is dead. The imperfect compared with the perfect is dead. Here, Abdu'l-Bahá took up a photograph of a virgin and child by Raphael and said, many babies at the time of childhood of Christ were living, but Jesus was more alive than they. It is not meant that the wicked after death will absolutely perish. This was the belief of the ancient Greek philosophers. They believed that whosoever did not attain any distinction or power of function on this plane of being perished. This is why Christ speaks of the righteous entering the kingdom of heaven and the wicked being cast into hell. This problem was not solved in any dispensation until it was solved in this dispensation. For the people ask, where is this kingdom in which the righteous dwell? The kingdom was spoken of by the prophets. The kingdom was spoken of by the prophets as heaven, it being said that man after death could ascend into heaven. Then afterwards it was found that there was no such place as heaven. The stars and planets are in truth all in motion and are not stationary, and are all material. It was then asked, where is hereafter? Existence must be visualized, must be made tangible, else it is non-existence. Any existence which is not realized on the material plane is only a figment of the mind. Therefore, existence must be externally realized. In response to the question, where is hereafter? Since we do not see it, we will say that as the mineral and vegetable belong to this world and are utterly ignorant of the human kingdom, one might question the mineral, finding it utterly ignorant of the vegetable, and one might even find that it denied the existence of the plant. And if one questioned the embryo and the matrix about the human kingdom, it would know nothing of it, and would even deny its existence. Even so, the realities of the kingdom are not known to man. Now we have an extract from a letter written on behalf of Shoghi Effendi. Regarding your question concerning a deep and profound study of the teachings, of course the Baha'is can and should meditate upon the significances of the writings and endeavor to grasp their meaning to the uttermost. There can be no possible objection to this. However, certain things are by their very nature a mystery to us, at least in our present stage of development. One of these is what the next world, the purely spiritual world, is like. To try and visualize that realm in the terms of this physical one is absolutely impossible. Abdul Baha has likened the relation of our souls in this world to our future life after death with the babe in its mother's womb. All the faculties the infant is developing are in the womb absolutely useless to it. However, when it is born, it suddenly discovers their use, uses its eyes, its ears, hands, lungs, etc., in its new environment. Nor could the baby have possibly visualized its life after birth while still unborn. So we cannot possibly understand or visualize what the condition and state of the future, purely spiritual world, is. To say it has time, space, and so on is to delineate it by terms applicable to this material world and alien to that spiritual one. The Guardian feels that while there is no harm in speculation on these abstract matters, one should not attach too much importance to them. Science itself is far from having resolved the question of the nature of matter, and we cannot in this physical world grasp the spiritual one more than in a very fragmentary and inadequate manner. One more letter in this section. From Shoghi Effendi also in 1943. He says, "You ask an explanation of what happens to us after we leave this world. This is a question which none of the prophets have ever answered in detail, for the very simple reason that you cannot convey to a person's mind something entirely different from everything that ever they have ever experienced. Abdu'l-Bahá gave the wonderful example of the relation of this life to the next life being like the child in the womb. It develops eyes, ears, hands, feet, a tongue, and yet it has nothing to see or hear. It cannot walk or grasp things or speak. All these faculties it is developing for this world. If you tried to explain to an embryo what this world is like, it could never understand. But it understands when it is born and its faculties can be used. So we cannot picture our state in the next world. All we know is that that world is as much better than this one as this one is better than the dark womb of our mother was. Our past is not the thing that matters so much in this world as what we intend to do with our future. The inestimable value of religion is that when a man is vitally connected with it, through a real and living belief in it and in the prophet who brought it, he receives a strength greater than his own, which helps him to develop his good characteristics and overcome his bad ones. The whole purpose of religion is to change not only our thoughts, but our acts. When we believe in God and his prophet and his teachings, we find we are growing, even though we perhaps thought ourselves incapable of growth and change." A reassuring letter written on behalf of the Guardian in 1943. No, not that I see. No. Now it remains for us to consider the evanescence of this world. That will have to be for next time. Now you tell me, do you want to go in this course slowly? Because we can take longer with it. At about the speed we're going now, it will take us some weeks to still cover these topics. But I think... Yes? Yes, because the notes on the epistle are still not ready. So we'll explore this theme. It gets more interesting. I think it's good to have a number of different tablets on the very same theme, because you begin, by the repetition, you begin to take possession of it, so to speak, to master at least the examples, so that you can speak about them with others and know that that's the proper response to describe this. Because it is a question which will arise in teaching and in deepening wherever we live. What is this next life, and how can we understand it? To what extent, to what degree can we comprehend it? And in some sense, visualize it.
You mentioned that the master said we shall remember this life. When we cross away, to what extent or degree do we remember this life?
I don't know of any references to the extent, except he says we'll remember loved ones and things that happen to us here. We won't forget them. Yes, well, I think you might have to remember it just right off when you get there, balancing it up. But we're told there's a review, you know, of... You become aware of what you did that was good and what you did that wasn't. Yes, there's some very interesting quotations about that. How, from the other world, they view their loved ones and the souls in this life. I don't know if they have to look at us in time, even though they're out of time, how that would be. Whereas our situation is unfolding. At least the quotes that I remember, it has them observing us in different conditions and concerned with us and praying for us, and so on. So. This is the question of why we can't understand the next world. How can there be? How can there not be time and still be sequence of events? Good question. You've confirmed what Abdu'l-Bahá says. We cannot understand the next world. But you have another week to think about it, and then we'll read some more.